Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So really?
We're rolling.
So Fraser, you're our Van Halen correspondent.
Oh, blimey, what have I done now?
And I think there's something about the makeup of the current Van Halen, as reformed and currently started on tour in the United States very recently, that makes them pretty much unique. Is How it? Many people in the group, Fraser, well, are called Van Halen?
Traditionally, there were two. There was Eddie on guitar, and then the drummer was also a Van Halen, a brother.
Alex Van Halen. And then there were a bass player called Michael Anthony.
Michael Anthony, yes.
And then there was David Lee Roth.
And he left, and Sammy Hagar came in, and all that kind of stuff.
Right, okay. But now they're all back
Hagar's
together.
Out now, and Hagar's David Lee Roth's back.
Yeah. Yes.
How many
well, Roth's been
Halen?
Back a while, but, he hasn't, yeah. but the new album is the first one they've done with him, I think.
So how many Van Halens?
Now there are three, I believe.
There are three? How does that work, Fraser?
They have a son in there, don't they? Wolfgang.
I was just about to say, I bet they've bred, obviously.
This is second generation. Yeah.
This is it.
It's like, of course.
There is Wolfgang Van Halen, who's Eddie Van Halen's son.
Yep.
One of many kind of bass players and people like that you find joining quite high-profile groups nowadays. It's not unusual, is it?
Yeah.
There was one I noticed the other week. I can't remember. Who is it? Peter Hook's currently... He tours with his son,
that's
doesn't
right.
he? I think that's
it's
right.
It's known as the Jason Bonham syndrome.
Okay. But there's also the Rick Wakeman thing, isn't it? Because his son now has his old part in Yes.
No.
I think Rick Wakeman's son is the keyboard player in Yes.
So Rick can't be bothered to do it anymore. No. Send the lad out.
So he just digs the boy out.
He takes commission.
Yeah. Takes his old dad's capes out of some wardrobe somewhere in the mansion. Dusts them down.
The latest thing in the Yes story is fantastic. You know, John Anson got ill and they decided to tour without him and then they introduced the singer from a tribute band. Recently, the singer from the tribute band has fallen ill, and instead of getting John Anderson back in, they've got another singer from another tribute band to replace him.
See, that's not insulting at all. No. If you were Anderson, you wouldn't be sitting at home now weeping, would you?
No.
You see, hiding under a huge cushion.
But imagine now the position of David Lee Roth in the reformed Van Halen. He's, he's the star and the focal point, but he's the only member... who's not in the family, you know what I mean? And if ever members of bands are prone to thinking that there's a conspiracy against them, he's more likely to feel that way than just about anybody, isn't he?
I'm sure they go into a huddle every now and again in the corner of the dressing room.
Over Sunday lunch.
Yeah,
we sorted out the set list earlier.
A series of Masonic handshakes. Start talking in weird, coded fashion, and he must feel very excluded.
But I'm saying also, I've got to make one further point. If Wolfgang Van Halen is in the group now, and let's say he's in his late 20s or something like that, probably is, I think there's going to be a group called Van Halen for the next 50 years, isn't there?
It's a franchise.
It's a franchise, isn't it? Surely. It's like the Osmonds.
So Wolfgang's kids would be playing lead guitar and bass.
It'll just kind of carry on, won't it?
2040 or something. Yeah, it will.
So watch this space. This is the Word podcast. We've had a busy week, haven't we? We had a gig on Monday.
You have been to today. You've been to two concerts. Is that right?
I went to
almost
two.
Unheard of.
And I'm going to a football match.
You haven't
match
been to a concert since the late 1970s.
That's not true.
What are they like? Can you sit down still?
That's not true. We had this joke, I think.
Oh, did we? Okay.
Yeah. I went to see, Randy Newman last night. But anyway, Monday night, we had our own Word gig, one of our Word in Your Ear series of gigs at our pub across the road, the Lexington. Left with Pictures, Emily Barker and the Red Clay Halo, who have been
or
on
Heroes,
the podcast.
I introduced them.
I wasn't going to say that.
I'm the guy who did the box set or beetroot routine without really tossing the coin, didn't I? I don't know. The people who won didn't see. The guy who won the box set, I think, wanted the beetroot because he didn't like The Wall by the Floyd. 170 quid's worth of stuff. And the guy who won the beetroot clearly won the box set. But I did something really crucial wrong, didn't I, Fraser?
I think you announced the coin toss without saying whether it was head or tails that was going to be the winner.
Oh, right. So I just went ahead. So you get the box set.
And
then you
kind of nominated a prize in the direction
of... Yeah, because they both seemed a bit put out. Yeah. I couldn't understand
I
why.
Thought it worked spectacularly well. I was enjoying it. But anyway, top
There's
of the
room
bill.
For improvement, I think.
There is, yeah.
Polish it. Top of the bill, Eliza Caffey and her band. They were extraordinary, weren't they? Well, the whole thing was extraordinary, wasn't it? The whole evening.
It sounds terrible, really, to talk about an event that we actually did promote ourselves.
Why?
But I have to say... it sounds as though we would be contractually obliged to say it was great, but I actually thought that Eliza Caffey was more than great. I thought that was... I don't know what you thought. I thought it was absolutely sensational.
She was terrific, but I was sort of watching from the side of the stage from my DJ eerie up in the top there. So I wasn't getting the full effect, but she was clearly remarkable.
On a number of levels, I thought it was absolutely extraordinary. I rather made a fool of myself by... tumbling into the dressing room directly after they'd gone off stage and delivering a kind of monologue about how fantastic I thought
like
it was. But then again, I think if you've just come off stage, you're probably quite pleased
That's
if somebody comes
leaving
and says, that was tremendous, you know.
See, musicians, when they come off stage, there's a post-coital glow about them, isn't there?
There is.
They want to be told, you know, darling, you were fabulous.
They do. They want you to light another cigarette. Anyway, yes, I do.
Yes, I've never had it like that before.
No, absolutely. You want to say the earth moved, et cetera. But the earth really did move.
Was that quick?
I thought... Too short a set. Your set's only 2.5 minutes long. Oh dear! But anyway, oh god.
But anyway, they were terribly good.
They were unbelievably good. I think various things struck me. I've seen Eliza Caffey play, but only in strange combinations, like the Floating Palace and other kind of collectives. And I've never actually, I suppose, seen her in her own right playing the kind of music she composes with the arrangements that she's. Invented, and I thought it was just astonishing. I thought it was astonishing for two reasons, actually. One is that musically, obviously she comes from this extraordinary Waterston-Carthy dynasty, and so she grew up with this amazing mixture of music, and so there's classical music in there, there's folk music in there, there's blues in there, music hall, wasn't there? A lot of music hall, and an amazing combination of instruments. And from where I was standing, Fraser and I were standing at the side of the stage, the double bass player, a girl with no shoes on, plucking and sawing away at the double bass. Behind her, a cello and then a brilliant drummer.
In a kind of wall
of perspective. He was in a studio.
And not just a really good drummer, a really good singer.
Brilliant singer, brilliant drummer. The whole band were fantastic. And so to see
and then these, a keyboard player.
But the bass, to see them playing their cello and bass in unison and in harmony, and one would play classical, one would play jazz, and they were just this extraordinary dynamic they got out of... the idea of a rhythm section with him playing these sort of military tattoos, you know, with those wonderful timpani sticks with great felt tips on them, you know. And yeah. he could roll drums with one hand. Not many people could do that. He was exceptional. And so they're playing this extraordinarily complicated sort of interwoven rhythm section and singing. The two girls sang a backing vocal. It didn't appear to be anything to do with what everyone else was singing. Did you notice that? They were singing their own part in perfect harmonies while playing these very complicated parts. So the musical side of it was very kind of rich and very fascinating, but the other side that really got to me was the kind of theatrical stagecraft, if you like, because she's grown up in a family with two performers. Her mother is a terrific presence on stage, and her father, you know, absolute legend, enormous dynamic about him. And she just got on stage and immediately took command.
She did.
She had an accordion and started playing. And she started with also wonderful introductions to these songs.
Yeah.
She does this song called Blood on My Boots, which she played at the Floating Palace show at the Barbican the other day, but without the intro. She simply cut to the point, which was, you know, I went to this show and I got a bit drunk, and she plays the song. And it's a song about her being down in London. And she gets great mileage out of that, you know, because she's one of those people who's from the north, but doesn't come down to London and be scathing about it. She's absolutely thrilled to be in London. Yeah. But is also standing outside of London and looking at London in a slightly quizzical fashion. And the whole gag is that for the first half of the show that she goes to, dressed up to the nines, on her own, it's an awards show, isn't it?
Jerry Springer, the opera,
that's right.
Yeah. The premiere.
For the first half, it's free drinks, so she's absolutely sucking down the fizz. And the second half, they charge you, and she does
five
about, it's five euro a glass. And she said, whenever I say that anywhere other than London, people go... bloody hell. People look at each other in absolute horror. The colour drains from their faces, you know. And if you say that in London, people think, Christ, I would have got a whole trailload.
That's a bargain.
I'll have six.
Where is it again?
Yeah, it's in Denver. That's brilliant. I'll have my birthday party
it,
there.
Happy hour.
Happy, I know. So that was very funny. But anyway, it was so great, the build-up that she did to this whole thing. She about a song where she's obviously going to get drunk. What she does in the second half of the song, of course, is the second half of the show, is she drinks other people's drinks. And that all goes horribly wrong. But yeah. You know that the song's called Blood on My Boots. And so, you know, in the title, there's a clue to how it's all going to end very messily.
It's one thing that's thrown me throughout the evening, actually. The one area that just fascinates me on shows like this is people's rapport with the audience. Now, the audience were fantastic.
Really?
The audience were
so respectful.
They were so respectful. I mean, I know at word gigs they always are, but this... these people were exceptional. It was, you know, you could have had a pin drop as the acts were playing. And you're in a pub.
Yeah.
This is really unusual. You know, we started off with Left With Pictures, who are very nice, but they're a little bit gauche. You know, they're the kind of... they don't look as if they're absolutely used to being on stage. But they did their best to kind of bridge the gap. They did their final tune kind
without
of
mics.
Beyond the PA,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Into the audience. And then you had Emily Barker and the Red Clay Heller, a bit more practiced. And, you know, they do the Good Evenings and We Are and all that kind of stuff. And then he just moves on to Eliza Carthy, who's just got that absolute assurance, you know, that she walks on stage and it's, I'm in charge now.
Completely in charge.
I'm in charge. And you can feel the audience... it's like something's been lifted from their shoulders because this person on stage has decided to be in charge.
Yeah.
They've taken that responsibility. And it's a wonderful, liberating thing when people do.
But it's also incredibly
so
relaxing,
many
isn't it? Because, you know, you think of those times you've willed some group to be good and you've wanted them to enjoy themselves as much as you're trying to enjoy them, but it becomes impossible because they look agonised or self-conscious or whatever. And it's like watching a public speaker with someone making a speech at a family wedding who clearly doesn't want to make the speech or can't wait for it to be over. That's a very difficult thing for everybody.
Because everybody feels
that. But to see even the worst speech by somebody who really wants to make it is fine.
It's fine.
Because they're just loving it and they're having fun and they're improvising. Yeah. I thought she was absolutely astonishing.
It was terrific gig. And actually, we were talking about this earlier and it made me think about great unexpected gigs you've been to. You know, that when people do their lists of, you know, greatest gigs I've ever been to, they always say, you know, I don't know, Bruce Springsteen at Wembley or something. You know, I always do Bob Marley and the Wailers That Lie Him. Well, it's obvious, you know, it's the kind of the big live album and all that kind of stuff. But actually, the things that you remember with most affection are very often the kind of small occasions, the where you find yourself in front of watching somebody unexpected or in an unexpected place or when the pressure was off or this, that and the other.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the ones that I remember that fit that description. And I've mentioned before, and I was actually checking the dates, I mentioned before Little Feat at the Rainbow in January 1975 when they went on as a support act to the Doobie Brothers.
Oh, yeah. And just blew them off stage.
And just completely blew them off stage. They were absolutely extraordinary. But then there was August the 12th, 1999, thanks to Wikipedia, I was able to look this up. I went to the 100 Club to see Richard Thompson and his band do a warm-up before the weekend of Crop Ready. They were playing Crop Ready at the Fairport Big
Brilliant,
Club.
Yeah.
And it was Richard Thompson and Danny Thompson, and I can't exactly remember. And then Teddy Thompson, who probably at the time was about 18 or something.
Turning to Van Halen, isn't it?
Yes. was playing additional guitar. And they were just absolutely electric. They were astonishing because they were rehearsed and they were ready, but there was no pressure on them.
Yeah.
You know, there was 100 people in the place, or yeah, probably a bit more than that. Yeah, they were kind of mates or fans or whatever. So it just had that wonderful, relaxed feeling about it. That was fantastic. But actually, my ultimate unexpected gig delight was November the 23rd, 1996, I saw Crowded House playing outside the Sydney Opera House in Australia, which is the famous Farewell to the World.
That's right. Across,
huge concert.
Across the...
Now, the reason that belongs in this list is That was when the concert was supposed to take place, on the 23rd of November 1996. But Sydney that day had one of its unbelievable rainstorms. And when it rains in Sydney, boy, does it rain.
Yeah, yeah.
So badly that they said, sorry, we can't let these hundreds of thousands of people onto this, you know, this Bennett Long Point, I think it's called, where the Opera House is. And so we're postponing it a night. But meanwhile, they had a sound check down at the, you know, the concert grounds with a bunch of fans who'd flown in from all over the world and couldn't change their tickets. So they said to them, well, you can come in and watch the, you know. So you were in this huge great festival. Well, there must have been a couple of thousand, which within that place nothing at all.
Yeah.
You know, you could wander around. You could walk right up the stage. You could walk right back. You could look at the Harbour Bridge or whatever. And they did the full show with the lights and absolutely everything. But again, the kind of pressure was off them because it was they were just running it through. And they had all, you know, they had a sound check warmed by audience reception. You know what I mean? And it was an absolute delight. The concert the following night was wonderful. But I actually prefer...
No, you would have done.
Of course. I suppose it's also absolutely. Because I'm one of the few that's there, you know.
Experience.
Yeah.
Did they react to the crowd?
Oh, yeah, they were completely... They did. They absolutely loved it. They were delighted with the whole thing. Everybody had just a, you know, kind of relaxed club-style experience, but within a huge...
That would have been a very great,
really impressive...
For both sides.
Yeah, the place. It was extraordinary. Oh,
brilliant.
Have you got any, Fraser?
A couple of thoughts of were with both soundcheck moments. Years and years and years ago, I remember seeing The Cure played a very small gig at the Garage, what was then the Town and Country Club 2 on Holloway Road. And I don't remember anything at all about the gig, but I remember Robert Smith playing an acoustic guitar and doing the Jam's English Rose during the soundcheck, which is the kind of thing you wouldn't expect him to do. And he did it beautifully and with a great deal of affection for the song. And I remember it really clearly.
How funny.
And the other one was when Oasis did their two enormous gigs at Nebworth. I was working at the event, and the night before the first of the two shows, they did a production rehearsal. And I sat out in the grass in front of the stage and watched them run through the entire set. And it was me and the guys in the sound desk and the guys up front of the lighting and the band and no one else.
Really?
I sat there by myself.
No.
The following day, there was, you know, 125,000 people.
That's absolutely
where I was, and I
cut the end. You were the one person.
I was the one person.
Like...
Yeah, at the end of the set, Noel nodded at me, and they walked off.
You've been listening to the free feed of the Word podcast. The full album-length version is only available to subscribers to the magazine. To sign up and to hear the rest of this podcast, go to www.wordpodcast.co.uk.